Hello and welcome to Sustainable Growth Out Loud, a podcast brought to you by Sustainable Growth Voice. I am your host, Julia Bottaro, and I'm here with my colleagues, Heather Dimpudi and Felicia Jackson, to talk you through about three stories that we think illustrate wider trends going on in corporate sustainability. So Heather, would you like to start with your story for the week?
Thank you, Julia. Yeah. So the story I wanted to talk about was basically this analysis that's been published by the Leonardo Center, which is a resource center within the Business School of Imperial College London. So basically what they did was they took the sort of sustainability related initiatives of over 6,000 companies, and these were publicly traded firms from any sector, any location. And upon analysing those 650,000 initiatives between 2000 and 2021, they realised that only about 6% of them were specifically focused on biodiversity. They were more to do with carbon generally, and even the ones that were focused on biodiversity, it was very much focused on life on land rather than life below water, when we know how important sort of the blue economy is in terms of carbon sequestration and in terms of the health of our planet. So it also had a bit of a worrying finding, which was that the sort of concentration of biodiversity initiatives had fallen within broader sustainability strategies. But on the positive side, it did note that some of these were actually improving. So where people had focused on biodiversity, it tended to be a much more holistic approach than had been seen before. So rather than just, you know, communicating about things, they were really integrating it into the entirety of their business model. So it sort of had a little look at the different sectors and realized that sectors where biodiversity may be a sort of more visible and more apparent issue, so that could be, you know, your mining, other extractive industries, a bit of agriculture probably, anywhere where biodiversity was sort of really obvious, they were more likely to be on top of it. Whereas industries such as finance or healthcare, where we know that biodiversity is sort of indirectly related. I mean, where do we think our healthcare ingredients come from and everything? But these sectors were just not particularly interested in biodiversity. And one of the sort of reasons they gave for this was sort of the lack of standardized reporting, the lack of standardized monitoring frameworks, just making it really difficult for people to make biodiversity strategies and then deliver on them. Because, you know, when you're in a corporate world and you've got a reputation to manage, you really have to deliver on your strategies. You have to deliver on your targets. You can't just make them and hope for the best. So I think this sort of challenge of like being able to show what they were doing was kind of discouraging people from doing anything on biodiversity. But having seen that sort of there were some improved strategies that had really taken the sort of holistic approach, it came to the recommendation that businesses should try and adopt specific biodiversity targets, but also just to sort of integrate them more broadly. So it recommends things like co-developed strategies. It recommends a more sort of shifts in mindset, shifts in culture, and the building of new governance structures. And I think that really speaks to what we talk about a lot at SG Voice, which is this sort of need for systemic change and holistic systems approaches that just take everything into account. And this will be helped by, you know, we've seen the development of the science-based targets for nature framework that's just come out recently, and then we've got the Task Force for Nature Related Financial Disclosures coming out shortly. So what we can hope is that that will kind of help to overcome the barriers of monitoring and reporting, and businesses will be able to take biodiversity into account. But also, it's not about forgetting the net zero targets, of course it's not. It's about integrating everything together and co-developing solutions that just account for everything and take into account the very way we do business, from our leadership mindsets to our organizational culture, and bringing all of it in together to address everything at once, really.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think they are in luck, all these companies that don't feel like they can develop targets, because as you said, there are so many frameworks coming up. And also in Europe, the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive does impose reporting on nature impacts. So for those big companies, some of them were probably the ones mentioned in this study, you know, they are the big companies that have to start reporting from 2025. So, you know, I feel that the excuse perhaps of the lack of frameworks might get old quite soon.
I think there's a couple of things that actually spring to mind here, one of which is it is always a challenge when the reason given for lack of action is a lack of frameworks, because it's a chicken and egg problem. Everyone says we need guidance to move forward, but, you know, well, if there isn't a policy framework, how's that going to move forward? And it's that idea that voluntary and mandatory frameworks are actually beginning to align. But I think what's particularly interesting about the potential for biodiversity is helping people shift a mindset. Heather, you were talking about, you know, the importance of understanding holistic approaches and system change. But actually, biodiversity in nature is almost the way in which we get to think about transition differently. Because if you're going to protect biodiversity, you have to think about your operations and your impact. But you also have to think about your supply chains, about your water use, not just where you are now, but where your products are being used. And in order to be effective, one of the things that, this is one of the things that always gets me about the sort of carbon versus biodiversity reporting, which is that carbon is something we can quantify, and not just carbon dioxide, but all GHGs, where they're emitted almost doesn't matter. They have a global impact. We're trying to solve a global problem. The challenge with biodiversity is that it's local, and solutions that work in one environment like a wetland are not going to work somewhere like a desert or somewhere with a depleted aquifer. So we have to understand you have to have operations working with locals, working with geography, working on a place-based basis, for lack of a better phrase. And I think potentially this idea that we're moving beyond net zero, this idea that we're moving towards this net zero nature positive transition is possibly that lever to understand the changes we need to see in a different way. I think a lot of our conversations are about the challenges of working in a silo and, you know, finance not working with marketing, not working with ops. But actually, if we can take this kind of approach across operations and across policymaking and across financial planning, we might have a completely different approach to how we set up frameworks. I don't know, I find it really exciting.
I think that's definitely an interesting point for you. And one of the things that this report did sort of very clearly state was that, you know, it is going to take a lot of co-creation when it comes up with strategies. And I think that taps into the place-based basis you were talking about, because specific suppliers will have different solutions, and tier three is going to be difficult when it comes to biodiversity, and that becomes really obvious when you look at sort of the different industries that are actually implementing policies already and the ones that are lagging behind a bit. I think that's what concerned me most, was that perhaps there are some businesses out there that still don't realise how much this matters to them, how dependent they are on nature and how much they are impacting nature. And I think it'll be really interesting to see how we develop that kind of supply chain engagement. So hopefully with reports like this coming out and the development of all those new frameworks, we will see such things come to take place.
And I do think that engagement piece is so critical, because we almost have this binary approach where people think we, you know, we always talk about the fact there's 10% of people on either end of a political spectrum that you simply can't persuade. But what we have to do is make people in that middle 80% understand this is not a binary issue. It's not a yes or a no. It's not a you can believe in climate change or you can't. These are the realities within which we're operating. If you follow the science, you know that we have to take certain actions. The question is how we go about doing that in an effective way that works for the environment, but that works for society as well. And of course, the economy, because that's fundamentally what we're talking about.
And this is where SG Voice comes in, may I say, providing useful data for all companies wanting to engage in the transition. Thank you very much, Heather, for your story. It's now time for the first break.
In this third episode of Series 2 of Gigawaters, brought to you by Sustainable Growth Voice and Energy Voice Out Loud,
in paid partnership with Ørsted, we're going to be looking at innovation, new technologies such as floating wind, and their role in the economic transformation currently taking place. This is really important as a driver of economic growth at a national, regional, and local level. For this episode, I'm joined by co-host Emma Toulson, lead stakeholder advisor at Ørsted, and our special guest, Claire Canning, program manager for the Offshore Wind Growth Partnership, part of the Global Offshore Wind Catapult. We're going to be looking at innovation in economic transformation and how this can affect skills, supply chain, and infrastructure in ways that highlight the benefits of the energy and net zero transition. This podcast is available now.
We are back from the break. It's now Felicia's turn to talk through us a story. She actually wanted to talk about climate litigation, but she's going to expand to address the issue of materiality.
So this is obviously a problem I have every week, which is trying to decide which of the stories we cover is the most important and which is telling us most about the direction of travel. So I started out wanting to talk about the growth in climate litigation, mostly because this week, actually, is the beginning of a trial in Montana where a group of young people have taken the state to court over their fossil fuel policies, which followed on from news last week that a federal case that got denied, I think, in 2020 has actually been given the green light to go ahead. So what we're seeing is this growth in climate litigation from all sorts of different groups for all sorts of different reasons. There was a report last year from the London School of Economics which said there were roughly 2,000 court cases in process around the world. And there was actually a really interesting piece I saw about how in the state of New Jersey, I think someone's managed to connect a climate change litigation case to something about the RICO statute. And anyway, it's incredibly complicated that I'm not going to go into the details of it. The reason I wanted to talk about the growth in climate litigation and this particular court case in Montana is it what it's telling us about where you need to start looking at material risk. Now, we've talked about greenwash a lot, and the other story I was fluctuating between, so it was either the court case in Montana or, bizarrely, the UK's Advertising Standards Authority wrapping the knuckles of Shell, Repsol and Petronas for misleading the public. And this is why materiality came up. Because basically, the ASA has said it's going to crack down on greenwash. Well, that's all well and good. The question, as always, is how, why, and what is your approach to what greenwash means? What's it telling us? Now, what was really interesting about the ruling was basically it said that these adverts were misleading because they didn't talk about the material impact of that sector. What they were saying was these adverts which showed particular focus on green options. So in the Shell ads, for example, it was all about promoting green credentials and, you know, its EV charging points, all of which are absolutely great. And Shell itself argued, you know, everyone knows it's in oil and gas. It's trying to get the public to understand what it's doing on the green side. Completely reasonable argument. But what's also completely reasonable is, actually, I don't think the public does pay that much attention to the detail. Why should they? You know, people are not looking to get involved with what Shell's doing. They're looking to get from A to B. They're looking to think, well, how do I get where I want to go? And they don't think, most people don't think, I know I'm going to use Shell charging points with my EV to get over there because I know they're there. They just go, I want to get there. Sorry, I'm obviously going round in circles here. My point being, that it is absolutely critical that companies understand that the expectation of their communications is fundamentally changing. So KLM, and it's not just the UK. In Germany, KLM got called up for talking about its sustainable aviation fuel. But again, the reason they got pulled up for their advertising was because it didn't talk about the material impact of their sector. And I think one of the things that most companies have been ignoring, there's been a lot of talk of targets, there's a lot of talk about wanting to do the right thing, everyone is pushing what they're doing is green or low plastic or low carbon. What are they fundamentally doing differently? What are they doing about the wider impact of their industry on society and the economy and the environment? Now, obviously, every individual company isn't responsible for making sure that every other company in the sector moves in the right direction. But the point is, you have to look beyond your own borders. And this comes back, Heather, to your story about biodiversity and different mindsets, which is that what society is beginning to ask companies to do is say, tell us the whole story. Represent the whole picture. Help us understand the implications of the choices we make. Because there are people out there, obviously, who want to do the right thing, and they will buy a product because they think it's green, or they will, you know, offset their airline flights because it makes them feel they're doing something good. The question is, are they, or is this simply a sop that allows companies to continue operating as normal? And that's where things like the ASA are bringing companies to task. It's where issues like climate litigation are changing the ground for everyone. You know, we talk about even playing fields for companies to compete. We're actually talking about a fundamental change in the expectations of how companies communicate, how they operate, and the sorts of risks they need to be aware of. One of the things that I think is particularly interesting on the litigation side is advertising is obviously communications. That talks about one particular area. But with the litigation side of things, you've got this top-down impact as well. It's about holding corporations and governments, you know, national, federal, state, whatever they may be, to that, you hold them to their obligations. If you think about the way that might play out further down a corporate environment, what about corporate officers or directors being sued for breaching fiduciary duty? What about professionals like engineers or architects who are sued for failing to consider climate risk in designing buildings? Or, you know, I mean, the list is endless, but I think we really are getting towards a tipping point. It's easy for us because we do, to a certain extent, live in a bubble where people are talking about this stuff all the time. But the reality is the framework, the regulatory environment, and the litigation environment are changing now in such a way that I don't think any company can afford to ignore what's going on. And that doesn't mean just setting a target and saying you'll do something. It means taking a good, hard look at what you do, where you do it, how you do it, and the impact of your products and services, and how you, within your company, but you within your sector and within the wider economy as a whole, can start becoming part of the solution instead of part of the problem.
I think there's so many challenges to overcome there, though, isn't there? I mean, when we talk about, you know, communicating the whole story of your industry and what you're doing, how you're sticking out without them, you know, if you've got a short ad on TV talking about your products, people don't want to hear about the centuries of oil and gas industry, you know, that you've been participating in for years and years before coming to the decision that you were going to promote EVs. And I think, I know that there is guidance and whatnot coming out, but it's a very difficult landscape for companies right now. And I think, and I'm surprising myself here, but I think sometimes we do actually have to be a bit sympathetic, really, in terms of what they are trying to deal with, what they're trying to manage. I think there's also some really interesting stuff with the litigation. You know, it's a kind of a historic thing when it comes to corporate law, is that a company has, you know, a company has no mindset of its own. It has no point of blame. So you get these massive, massive issues that end up getting covered in a relatively small settlement, because you can't just point the finger at someone and say, you did this. And I will be interested to see how it all unfolds.
But I mean, that's actually part of the point of this kind of litigation, because there have been moves to have corporations be treated like individuals for purposes that perhaps are in their favour. But it's about legal precedent. It's about how the law is interpreted. That's what we're talking about. That's why we're not there. You know, and I think your point about how difficult it is for companies and for individuals to manage or to navigate these thorny paths is incredibly valid. I suppose what I'm excited about is the fact that there is a shift in the expectations of what we're trying to do. and that there is an opportunity through working together to find effective ways through it. I think, for me, I think my point is that you can't just do this in isolation anymore, because you have to look to what wider expectations are.
I feel there is so much to say on this topic, but unfortunately we need to go on a break now.
Can I just say, Julia, I think we're probably going to come back to it again and again, because we even had a conversation about whether or not we should talk about it today, because we covered it a few weeks ago. But anyway.
I'm sure we will, and now it's time for the break.
I'm Andrew Dykes, content editor at Energy Voice and host of The Megawatt Hour, a podcast box set series brought to you by Energy Voice in paid partnership with BDO. This series sees us examine the state of energy storage technologies and their wide-ranging effects on energy markets. So far, over the course of our series, we've looked a lot at the big picture: grid-scale batteries, seasonal storage, and the policy and investment landscape underpinning major developments across the country. In our latest episode, we're drilling right down to the small scale to focus on where we're most likely to interact with storage technology in our daily lives, in our homes. As home energy systems become increasingly smarter, storage is set to play a greater role in how we use and consume energy, and will hopefully not only help us use greater amounts of renewables, but may even save us some money. So join me, my roster of BDO co-hosts, and a range of diverse guests from across the energy and climate sector to learn more. Look for The Megawatt Hour on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or in your regular Energy Voice Out Loud feed, wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back from the break. Time for the third and last part of the podcast, and it's my turn to talk about a story that I wrote recently. Initially, I wanted to talk about energy efficiency because there was a big update by the International Energy Agency last week, but then we were discussing stories and actually thought, this other one about the ESG debate in the US is actually more funny. So what's happening is that for those who might not be in the know, there's been a sort of ideological war up on ESG in the States. The Republican establishment believes that ESG is a woke ideology and cannot be used in investing because it goes against the best interest of hardworking Americans in the fossil fuel industry and whatnot. While in reality, everyone in the finance industry is aware that ESG is more a risk-adjusted investment lens. So it's a way to understand what risks are coming in a world that is changing. And so despite all of this, there's been a rise in funds that are actively marketing themselves as anti-ESG. So Morningstar has done a study on them. It found 26 funds in its database that could be classified as such, and it divided them into 5 mutually exclusive categories. So first of all, there were the anti-ESG funds that would use ESG data to build portfolios by tilting toward companies that management believes are unduly penalized by ESG rating providers. Then there were the political funds that would commonly refer as to ESG investing as part of the woke liberal agenda. So they invest in companies that they think are supporting conservative aligned values. Then there were these renouncer funds that they previously said that they would adhere to ESG investing principles, but then they changed their minds, amid this whole backlash. Then there were the vice funds, so they would invest in companies that are maybe in the tobacco industry, alcohol, weapons, and gambling. And then finally, there were the voter funds. So they are traditional passive funds that vote at AGMs in opposition to ESG principles. So when you look at how this industry has been doing recently, it's quite interesting. So these ideologies have been going on for the past 2 decades, but really the movement against ESG picked up a lot last year. And so Morningstar found that the flows of money into these funds actually peaked in the third quarter of 2022 with $376 million, which is not a lot of money. And then it also found that
demand, even though the money peaked this March, and it mostly went into a fund launched by Strive that was focused on US energy companies. And then when you look at the performance between 2017 and 2022, these funds actually lost an average of $1.2 million each quarter, while in comparison, US equity fund attracted $980 million each quarter. So in short, they've not been doing well. And to be honest, it's not surprising, because if you go against ESG, like if you invest in companies that are not addressing long-term risk, you're basically asking to lose money. I mean, it's just absurd. But yeah, just finally, before I move, I see what Heather and Felicia have to say on this. Even though these were obviously higher risk and by Morningstar analysis, they consider them very high risk, they also found that there was some positive impact, because these companies, these funds still invested in companies that are somehow engaged in the transition. Because, I mean, lots of companies are engaged in the transition. For example, one of them is NVIDIA, which is making chips. It's a company that makes chips, and chips are key for technologies like electric vehicles. So even though they don't want to be ESG, they're still supporting the energy transition. So yeah, very controversial. I mean, what do you guys think?
I mean, personally, I just find it absolutely hilarious. You just think, okay, I'm going to set up a fund which, by virtue of its being so bad for the planet and people, it won't give me any profits, everyone's going to hate it, and it won't make any money. And you just like, I mean, correct me, I realise that's an oversimplification, but it's the most petty, throwing your toys out the pram kind of move, isn't it? Just like, oh, everyone's getting too woke and environmental.
Now.
Sorry.
You do have to be reasonable, because people are allowed to have different perspectives and different worldviews. And there are people who do genuinely believe that, you know, ESG is an ideology. I don't know how they think that, but they do genuinely believe it. So, and to a certain extent, and I'm stretching my devil's advocacy here, to a certain extent, you can argue that if you look at what happened last year with Ukraine, that investing in traditional energy sources is good short-term business. So I think one of the big issues is this disconnect between the trade-offs that we actually have to make, that there is long-term risk which will have a hugely detrimental impact. I mean, pollution, for example. Pollution is a serious, serious problem. It destroys the environment. It's detrimental to nature, to biodiversity, therefore to ecosystems, therefore to the economy. But it also gets, you know, gets fined and all sorts of different things like that. I think one of the funds in, you know, one of the companies in one of these funds got fined, I suppose it's only 14 million, which to a major corporation isn't very much, but it got fined for air quality violations. I agree with you that a focus on doing the opposite of the best for the planet seems, well, I would define it as a choice.
I think what I would say is that, you know, if it is a choice to invest in something that is bad for the planet, okay, that's a choice that some people might make. I can't quite put myself in that mindset. You may be surprised to hear. But to do so with the full knowledge that it's not paying you back, I'm like, what motive could you possibly have other than pettiness and
politics? Politics. Do not forget, when you can, there's a lot going on where people will stand up and say they believe something because they think it will do them some good politically. I mean, let's not forget what happened in Brexit and the things we were told, for example, about how much money would go directly to the NHS if we pulled out of Europe. I don't think many people still believe that that was accurate, I hesitate to say truth while I'm being recorded. I think the big question here, and I'm enjoying this conversation because I think we all, that there are some clear points to be made on the particular choices about angling finance to funds that ignore risks. But it does bring up the question of whether or not the current financial system is fit for purpose. Now, I know that's a little bit of a big topic for the few minutes we've got left in this podcast, but actually, that question is, if money is about making short-term return for shareholders, are we doing the right thing by investing in well-managed, risk-aware, nature-positive net zero funds? I would argue yes. But I would also argue that other points can be made, and the other points that can be made are telling us there's something wrong with the financial system.
I understand the point of why someone would want to create these funds. But despite this whole support, apparent support for the anti-ESG sentiment in the US, the market is speaking. Like, people don't want to buy into these funds. So you might create them all you want, but then you make a loss as the fund manager. So, I just wanted to say, I think this is reassuring because people don't want to buy into these funds. And like, even though these exist and it's a bit shocking, at least they're not successful.
Well, I think what's really sad actually is that these funds are being created. I have to admit, I haven't looked into an enormous amount of detail, but I don't think they're targeting institutional investors. I think they're targeting individual investors. And I think there's a lot of individuals who are being taken advantage of by being offered things that speak to their political reality without thinking about their long-term future. Just an opinion.
Yeah, that's true. There are a lot of ETFs there. So that is a really good point, actually.
I love it when I make one of those.
This podcast is full of good points.
Definitely. But I think, you know, it's sometimes the stuff we cover is a bit odd. But it's a great choice of story, Julia, honestly.
It is. Thank you. I'm sure there will be more from all of us. It's now time to close, unfortunately, but I hope our listeners enjoyed. Please do remember to sign up to our newsletter, follow us on LinkedIn, follow us on our website, follow us everywhere, really. We deserve it. Thank you so very much, and see you in 2 weeks.